Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine. And we're going to start this week with the March 11th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And our first article is What We Owe 2020-somethings. And it's by Eric Kleinenberg. In January 2020, Luis was 21 and beginning the second semester of his junior year at a public university in New York City. He lived with family in Queens, and everyone pitched in to make ends meet. His father was retired. His mother collected disability insurance. His older sister, with whom he shared a bedroom, was a veterinarian technician. Luis worked at a law firm. The apartment was crowded, loud, and sometimes crazy. But in New York City, what isn't? Luis was out in the world anyway, because when you're in your 20s, the world is yours. When COVID-19 hit, Luis's universe suddenly narrowed. No school, no job, no parties, no friends. Soon his whole world and his family had the virus. It was scary, because by then, Queens was one of the most dangerous places on the planet, with mobile morgues standing outside overflowing hospitals. A few weeks earlier, Luis was looking at graduate schools and thinking about a new life in a new city. Now his main goal was to survive. Luis was one of 33 college students and recent graduate whom Isabel Carluzzi, an NYU doctoral student, and I had interviewed for a book about the year 2020. They were a diverse group, so it was striking to find so many commonalities in their pandemic experience. Stress, anxiety, and a generalized insecurity from which they have yet to be relieved. Deep uncertainty about the nature of the post-pandemic world, feeling obligated to make enormous sacrifices for the good of others, with no one in power ever naming, recognizing, honoring, or compensating their losses. Losing faith, not only in the core institutions that anchor society, but in the idea of society itself. By summer of 2020, Luis had fully recovered a sense of smell and taste. But I lost everything, he reported. His family, once stable, was impoverished, relying on food pantries. After George Floyd was murdered, he joined in protests that lasted throughout the summer. It was connected to the pandemic, says Luis. It was boiling over at that point, this kind of mistreatment. Some things got lost or put on hold. Luis gave up on graduate school for fear of condemning himself to years of online classes. His social life remained non-existent. The toll of the deprivation was unmistakable. In some ways, the pandemic had stalled his development. In others, it aged him. I grew up like 10 years in the pandemic, he told us. A remarkable number of 20-somethings we interviewed expressed that same sentiment. Active, dynamic, and occasionally experimental or boundary-crossing social relationships are key features of what social scientists call the extended adolescence. During ordinary times, most young American adults enjoy an open, freewheeling, permissive cultural environment, one that encourages and rewards the formation of social ties. The psychologist Jeffrey Arnett emphasizes the optimism and emergent sense of possibility that people in their 20s often feel during this period. Young people use this life stage to build up their personal and professional networks, setting up support systems and friendship groups that will nourish them even if they put off marriage. The pandemic produced a social famine. Its after effects persist. During 2020, young adults who had been relatively carefree in their social lives quickly became circumspect and judgmental. Behavior was loaded with the new significance. Wearing masks or attending parties became emblems of politics and values. Everyone became a judge. A 2023 Gallup poll found Americans between the ages of 12 to 26 express strikingly low levels of trust in political and social institutions, and those between 18 and 26 are considered more cynical than slightly younger peers. The distrust extends from civic life and to their social networks, making everyone a bit more defensive. I definitely have categories of friends now that I didn't have before, says Jamie, a 25-year-old actor. Most of my close friends are behaving how I am behaving, trying to be a good person, I guess. Others, I might never thought I'd hang out with again because they behave so poorly. When campuses closed, the disruption was both acute and long-lasting. Some never made the transition to remote education. Others simply lost interest and motivation. Fear, disorientation, and self-doubt were common themes in our conversations. I don't know what I want to do anymore, says Charisse, a 25-year-old public university graduate. I met with a career advisor and they asked what I was interested in, and I just went blank. For others, profound uncertainty gave rise to new commitments. Before the pandemic, Angelica, a 21-year-old Latina student, used her income as a paralegal to pay for things like nights out. When she had to file for unemployment after March of 2020, she felt some shame at not being economically independent. The shock of insecurity led her to invest in her future, paying down maxed-out credit cards when she found work again. It's so funny, she says, being a finance and economics major and finally understanding the value of a dollar in my last year because of a personal experience through COVID. Some people's need for intimacy intensified and accelerated their relationships. Some couples made big leaps at the outset of the crisis, deciding to quarantine together even though they had never cohabitated. Others jumped into a serious relationship. Many said they reconnected with people they had casually dated but not given much thought to before the lockdowns, or rekindled romances they thought that had flamed out. The biggest opportunities involve more political concerns. Studies show that some 15 million to 26 million Americans participated in the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, with adults between the ages of 18 to 34 expressing by far the most support. In my interviews, I learned that beyond police violence against black people, 20-somethings were also incensed by the glaring governmental failures and other forms of injustice that had become so apparent in the pandemic. That summer, millions of young Americans were beginning to believe a better world was possible. They marched, they organized, and they did something seemingly routine but massively consequential. They registered to vote. The civic reawakening of young Americans pushed participation among the 18 to 29-year-old Americans to record levels in 2020, with 50% voting in the presidential election compared with 39% in 2016. Joe Biden needed all of this 20-point margin that he won among these voters to reach the White House. Americans came out because they believed he would transform things. They've been disappointed. Nothing has restored their faith in the future, and at election time, to a large extent, the future may well be in their hands. We've had years to reckon with the cascading crisis of 2020, but instead of processing what we went through, we've largely repressed our collective traumas and neglected to recognize what it took to survive. For young people, we know the coronavirus was far less dangerous than for older generations. It may have been reasonable to demand that they give up things that they hold sacred, from social and educational opportunities to jobs and careers, for the common good, and for the health of more vulnerable people. But surely we owe them something in return. At a minimum, America's 20-somethings deserve recognition for their sacrifices, but something more substantial seems appropriate, given how much we asked for them when everything was on the line. Respect, debt relief, college scholarships, compensation, perhaps. Today, none of these are either major party platforms. Everyone wants to win over young people, but no one has offered meaningful support or even thanks. Kleinenberg, the Helen Gould Shepherd Professor in the Social Sciences and Director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University, is the author of 2020, One City, Seven People, and a Year Everything Changed. Now let's head over to the brief. In the opener, we have Trump and His Many Trials, and is by Brian Bennett and Eric Cortalesa. The first of Trump's criminal trials could be the goofiest of them all against him. When Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg indicted Donald Trump last April, the case drew some derision. Prosecuting a former president over hush money payments to a porn star seemed trivial, according to critics, and relied on a legal technicality to bump the charges up to felonies. Given that three of the other cases were targeting Trump for trying to overthrow the 2020 election and refusing to return national security secrets, Bragg's case, the first criminal indictment of a former president in U.S. history, seemed like weak sauce. But after 9 months and 91 felony charges in four courts, the New York case has become less of an afterthought. In fact, it might end up being the main show. Bragg, more than Special Prosecutor Jack Smith or Fulton County, Georgia District Attorney Fannie Willis, may be the best positioned to secure a felony conviction of Trump before the election. New York State Judge Juan Merchan recently cleared the way for jury selection to begin on March 25th and said the trial could last for 6 weeks, setting up a possible verdict in May. If convicted, Trump could face up to 4 years in prison. While Trump's inner circle says it would prefer none of the charges and the trials happen before Election Day, some see the New York case coming to trial first as the next best outcome for the former president. "It's the goofiest of all the cases," says a Republican strategist close to the Trump campaign. If Trump beats this case, it sets the tone and feeds into his narrative that all of these cases are a witch hunt. Bragg's prosecution hinges on the timing of Trump's efforts to cover up a sex scandal weeks before the 2016 election. Trump is charged with 34 counts of faking business records to hide payments to actor Stormy Daniels, intended to stop her from publicly describing a sexual encounter. Bragg has argued that the charges should be bumped up to felonies from misdemeanors because the payments were in service of a federal crime, election interference. Trump's legal team has tried to toss out the indictment on grounds that state laws don't apply to federal elections and that the case was politically motivated. Merchant rejected these claims, which Bragg and his staff saw as further bolstering the wisdom of their legal strategy. "The core of the case is not money for sex," Bragg said in a December 22nd interview with WNYC New York Public Radio. "We would say it's about conspiring to corrupt a presidential election and then lying in New York business records to cover it up," says Bragg. Bragg recently bulked up the team handling the case by adding Joshua Steinglass, who has tried high-profile homicides and also worked on white-collar cases that led to tax fraud convictions of Trump organizations last year. Steinglass joins the chief of the investigation division, Susan Hoffinger, Chris Conroy, a member of the district attorney's office for 2 decades, and Matthew Colangelo, a former senior Justice Department official. The New York case comes as the other three criminal cases against Trump, 2 in federal court and 1 out of Georgia, have encountered delays and other roadblocks. For months, legal experts expected the federal case against Trump for trying to overturn the 2020 election to be his first criminal trial. But Trump succeeded in derailing a March 4th start date as his bid to claim immunity for anything he did as president wound its way through the courts. The trial date for the other federal cases over Trump's refusal to return classified documents from Mar-a-Lago is also in flux amid Trump's pre-trial motions and other legal maneuvers. And then there's the Georgia election interference case, which got snarled in lurid legal challenges over Willis's personal relationship with the lawyer that she appointed to lead the investigation into Donald Trump. Even if that trial was to kick off this year, it would not likely reach a verdict before Election Day. While the New York case is poised to go first, Bragg previously said he wouldn't stand in the way if another case was ready. "There's other dockets here. Broader justice may warrant another case going first, but we stand at the ready," he said during a January 8th interview with NY1. If Trump wins the election, He could stop the Justice Department from pursuing the federal cases that are against him, as well as try to pardon himself. As the Georgia and New York cases deal with state crimes, a president's pardoning power would not apply. Legal experts remain at odds over what a state conviction would mean for a sitting president. It's uncharted territory that would likely end up having to be untangled by the U.S. Supreme Court. Polling suggests that Trump could lose significant support if he is convicted of a crime. His camp insists he is the rare political figure who could surmount even that scenario. Even with a conviction in any of these cases, President Trump is still neck and neck with Joe Biden, according to a close source to Trump. That should scare the hell out of the Democrats. Next, we have the bulletin, how South Korea is tackling its demographic crisis. South Korea is projected to become the world's most aged country by the year 2044. Last year, the number of people in their 70s exceeded those in their 20s for the first time ever, and some 24.5% of those between the ages of 70 and above were still working as of January, according to local media reports. South Korean authorities welcomed the growing number of elderly workers as a solution to the labor shortages caused by the demographic shift, a problem faced by several economies around Asia. In Japan, one in every 10 people is 80 years old or older, making it the country with the highest proportion of elderly in the world. The World Bank considers China a super-aged society, and Singapore is on track to join it by the year 2026. First, we have elderly at work. In South Korea, elderly employment has risen steadily since the country's statistics authority started to collect the data in the year 2005. Half of these workers are age 75 and above, and 42.1% are considered simple laborers, with jobs that are not specialized and require just a few hours of training. Some 30% are in the agricultural, fishing, and forestry industries, with 22.8% working in social affairs and the service industry. Next, we have incentivizing youth. Meanwhile, authorities are scrambling to address the aging demography, encouraging employment at all ages and boosting low fertility rates. To entice couples to have bigger families, the South Korean government has even mulled granting military exemption to men who have three or more babies before they turn 30. And lastly, we have ripple effects. Any aging population comes with wide-ranging effects, including increased health care and welfare costs. In South Korea, the official retirement age of 60, which was raised from 58 in the year 2017, was first set when life expectancies were shorter. Longer lifespans today, and consequently longer time spent in retirement without income, are at the core of the nation's demographic challenge. South Korean labor unions are urging companies to raise the retirement age once again so workers can earn regular wages for just a few more years. Next, we have, from the brief, good question. Why are we more exhausted than ever? And it's by Emily Ballesteros. People are tired, like really tired, as evidenced by recent trends such as quiet quitting, coffee badging, bare minimum Mondays, and most of all, the Great Resignation, when over 47 million Americans voluntarily resigned from their positions. People are feeling a strain on more than just their work calendars. They're feeling it in their spirits. We're now in the era of the Great Exhaustion, what writer and computer science professor Cal Newport has called a time when people are looking to reestablish their relationship with work in order to reduce their pervasive sense of drain. People feel so fatigued that they're cutting out activities that used to be commonplace and low stress, like working out and going to the supermarket. Factor in recovering from the pandemic, inflation, and global stressors, and you've got a recipe for complete physical, mental, and emotional exhaustion. So why are levels of exhaustion increasing? The three factors that are commonly overlooked but are contributing the most are unsustainable lifestyles, exposure to stress outside of your control, and financial insecurity. We've normalized these facets of our lives, but this normalization has caused us to disregard their impact on our physical and mental well-being. New York Times bestselling author Dan Buettner spent his career studying the blue zones, the areas in the world where people live longer, healthier lives than anywhere else. In his work, he explains that people who live in the blue zones have one thing in common. They live a human needs first lifestyle, in which the things we need as human beings are prioritized. That means eating whole foods, having rich social lives, getting regular movement, and working with a purpose rather than for the sake of maximizing productivity. This is a stark contrast to most people's realities. Outside of these blue zones, most people eat processed foods, strategically plan activities to socialize and get movement, and treat work like it comes before everything else. Daily life is about enduring demands. We have not built a human needs first society. We have built a business needs first society, and it's starting to show. 50 years ago, a single income could afford you a house, a car, wife and kids. Nowadays, you're lucky if a dual income can afford you some of those things. Having a hard job that supports your lifestyle is one thing. Having a hard job that barely pays the bills is another. Much of the exhaustion we are seeing is frustration that working full-time or more doesn't translate to the same security and buying power it used to. Why are we working if not to afford the lifestyle that we desire? When that lifestyle, going to a restaurant on a special occasion, going to a concert with friends, getting your kids the Christmas gifts that they want, becomes unaffordable, frustration is understandable. Frustration over time turns into defeat, and defeat looks an awful lot like exhaustion. We've been a work-centered society for generations. However, it is becoming increasingly harder to persuade people to live a busy, work-centered life when it doesn't translate to the quality of life that it used to. The confluence of unsustainable lifestyles stress out our control, and financial insecurity creates a very tired group of people. The good news is that there are things within our control that can improve our quality of life and reduce exhaustion. Consider what augments your quality of life and what makes you feel energized. Then consider what lowers your quality of life and makes you weary. At the end of the day, how we feel is determined by small decisions that we make. How much sleep we get, prioritizing a morning walk with a friend, consuming media thoughtfully, refusing to discuss work and work stress when we are off the clock, these small things make a big difference, but we must do them consistently and relentlessly. We can't wait for changes to come down from the top down. We must address the factors of exhaustion within our control to ensure that we live healthy, peaceful, and satisfying lives. Ballesteros, the writer of this article, has a master's degree in industrial organizational psychology and is the author of The Cure for Burnout. Next we have Died, Alexei Navalny, founding father of the future Russia, and is by Mikhail Zygar. On January 1st, 2015, Alexei Navalny called me. "Well, you and us have no one else but you and us. Let's work together," he said. It was indeed a hard time for both him and me. I was editor-in-chief of the DOZ HD TV channel at the time, and we were cut off from all cable and satellite operators. But Navalny, who died at the age of 47 on February 16th in a Siberian prison, faced much worse. The criminal case invented to force him to stop his political activities. That time, Alexei was given a suspended sentence, but his brother was imprisoned. That year, I wrote a book called All the Kremlin's Men. One chapter was about Alexei, and I described him as follows, quote, "Navalny is a unique person who made a conscious choice. As yet, he has no power and may never have, but he has certainly sacrificed the chance to lead a normal life, although he describes it as an opportunity to change Russia for the better," unquote. I was naive at the time. All of us were. We would never believe that Vladimir Putin wanted him dead. because we thought that he didn't want Navalny to be a martyr. I always thought Alexei is very morally strong. He's a historical figure. He cannot die. About a week before his death, I received a letter from Alexei. It was, of course, incredibly funny and energetic. He wrote that he was sitting in a cell from which you can't see a blade of grass or a leaf, and even to take a walk, he was taken only to the neighboring cell. But he wrote it so cheerfully and dashingly that there was no doubt that everything was all right. He also wrote about Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Nabokov, Solzhenitsyn, and Vysotsky. He was glad that in the new colony he was able to reread Crime and Punishment. I think many of us thought he was a magician. At some point he cast some sort of spell. Putin disappears and Alexei becomes the president of Russia. But it turns out it wouldn't be like that. He won't be the president of any future Russia. He'll have to be its founding father. For many years, Russia was a very cynical country. Many people seriously believed that there was no democracy in the world. There was no freedom of speech, only propaganda everywhere, and there was no such thing as fair justice. But Alexei believed in those values, and he gave his life for it. So now we have to believe, and the next generations will grow up and learn by looking at him, and they will also believe. Now all those people who are mourning Alexei Navalny are Russia's future. He united us and asked us not to give up. You and us have no one else left but you and us. Let's work together. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from the March 11th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.